Although the following conversation is sponsored by John Hancock, the opinions and legal views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily reflect John Hancock's views on any of the issues discussed. Please listen to the important disclosures at the end of this broadcast.
Welcome to John Hancock's Advanced Markets Radio. I'm your host, Ray Innings. Today we have Barry Flagback on the program. Barry is the founder of theinsuranceadvisor.com. He's on the program today with Randy Zipsy to talk about fiduciary responsibilities of purchasing life insurance inside a trust. So Barry Flag and Randy Zipsy.
I'd like to welcome back to the show a friend and a past guest, Barry Flag.
Hey, Randy.
What I've asked you to be on our show with is a kind of a continuation of what we've talked about in the past, and that is some of the fiduciary responsibility questions that come along with the purchase of life insurance inside of trusts. Certainly, there are lots and lots of trusts that own life insurance contracts. Trusts continue to get established with life insurance contracts in them. And over the years, I've been somewhat unimpressed with the amount of attention that trustees give to these trusts. And I know, Barry, that's really where you've built your expertise, and I guess that's really what your business does, is advise trustees on those sorts of issues. So, again, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back, and I couldn't agree more. Our business is probably more about equipping trustees with the information necessary to make suitability determinations than it is advising them or equipping those that advise trustees with the information to make suitability determinations. And you're right. I think that the number of trustees that have been focused on such issues in the past is much less than you and I really deem prudent, and I think much less than we'll be in the future. So always happy to talk about it.
Well, the reason and the timing for this particular show is a few weeks back, I've been on the road and I was speaking to a very bright individual who is a senior trust person at a corporate fiduciary, and we were talking about life insurance. And this person actually, unlike a lot of the folks that have that role, was pretty knowledgeable when it comes to life insurance, actually. But they said something to me that really got me to thinking, and I called Barry up to see whether my thoughts were the same as his on this issue. And what that person told me was is that their trust department buys exclusively inside of the trust contracts with an NLG on them. And the reason they buy exclusively NLG contracts, why they don't purchase current assumption contracts, they only purchased no lapse guarantee contracts, is because they want to be sure that the death benefit is paid and also that those contracts are easier for them to do the administration on. And in today's environment, with interest rates as low as they are now, and, you know, with the prospect of higher interest rates and inflation out there because of the tax situation that we're in, with the uncertainty over the estate tax that we have and the fact that NLG contracts have such a low cash value to them, whereas current assumption contracts tend to be more flexible and have more cash. I just had a real problem with somebody saying to me, we don't even look at current assumption contracts. We only look at NLGs because we want to be certain that it's going to pay and it's easier to do the administration on. So that really was why I made that call and why we've scheduled this. So with that kind of preamble here, I'm going to throw it out to you, Barry.
Well, you know, I think that the administrative concerns and certainly the safety or the surety that a claim will be paid are more than two considerations that trustees need to evaluate in their prudent process. But the prudent process also talks about some others, and the default of just going to guaranteed type products reminds me of a case you and I have talked about, the considerable parallels that I see between the evolution of the investment business as it was changed by ERISA and the evolution that we're in the early stages of here of the life insurance business as it's being changed by the Prudent Investor Act. And the case, it was a long time ago. I don't remember the name of the case, but I remember working in my father's financial planning firm, and he was doing pension investment advisory work and used to use as an example case an employer who, with very good intentions, very reasonable intentions, allocated all of the retirement monies to CDs and, you know, diversified them among banks so that there was, you know, everything was FDIC insured. And this was back in the 80s when interest rates were high. So, you know, they had a high interest rate. They had certainty backed by the federal government or the FDIC that the CDs would be paid. The trustee of the retirement trust, the employer, thought he had taken the most defensible position he could possibly take. And lo and behold, an employee leaves or was terminated, I don't recall which, and the employee sued the trustee for breach of fiduciary duty. And the trustee, the case, because on the heels of the interest rate bubble and its decline, the stock market, as we know, took off. And it wasn't that the trustee was right or wrong. The employee sued for breach of fiduciary duty for not having a process that considered the things that the Prudent Investor Act, or ERISA in this case, which is the same things that the Prudent Investor Act requires as it relates to suitability, didn't consider those things. And the trustee actually lost, even though they were getting very good interest rates and they had complete certainty, they lost because they had a prudent process. So the moral of the story is a couple things. One, it's not just those things that may be important to the trustee, and it's also not just whether or not the outcome is good or not, because in this day and age, anybody can sue for anything, and a beneficiary, in fact, I'm aware of a case in Colorado where beneficiaries sued the bank trustee, not because they really thought that there was anything wrong with the islet, but because they were upset about investment performance in another trust. And so they were just throwing this on top. It was kind of the soft underbelly because the trustee did not have a prudent process. So I think you're right. It is not just certainty of the guarantees and ease of administration. While those two things are important, they're far from the only things that need to be considered.
I think that what you point out is, as our listeners walk away with this, I think there are really two things that I take away from this is, one, you have to have a process. You have to look at all your investments as a trustee, including life insurance, and have a process and make a decision on how you're going to invest based upon a logical process. And part of that process, I think, and now this is just my view, and you can tell me if you agree or not agree with what I think here, but I think as part of that process, you should look at the insurance alternatives, the insurance options that are out there. And when you look at current assumption products versus NLG products, what you've got, if you look at the pros and cons of both, are as in the NLG, as we said right at the top, is you have certainty on what is going to get paid, and you have a certain amount of ease of administration. But on the current assumption side of things, at least today, with a lot of the current assumption products that are out there, situations where the costs of those products are pretty significantly less than the corresponding NLG product. And also, those current assumption products may have, at even a lower cost, may have significant cash values that aren't available in those NLG contracts. So when you look at those two products, I think you have to have a process and you have to consider what the purpose of the trust is and what all the facts are, and then make a decision on what makes the most sense in that circumstance. I don't think that, I think it's fair to say one is always going to be better than the other one, but you have to have a process and a plan and look at kind of the spectrum of what's available out there and then make an intelligent decision based upon that.
I could not possibly agree more. The prudent process prescribed by the Uniform Prudent Investor Act, as it's adopted in some 40-plus states now, some of which have carved out language to not apply it to life insurance trusts, but for the most part, there's some 40-some states that have a process that is substantially similar, defined by that state's Prudent Investor Act, and it clearly makes no reference to product. It even implies, you know, a trustee can be flat out wrong in their choice as long as their process is prudent. In other words, the results can be not what the beneficiaries expected or wanted, as long as their process meets certain ingredients for prudence. You touched on how we as a life insurance industry, we seem to start conversations with the product. You know, is NLG or guaranteed UL better than current assumption UL? Or is universal life better than variable life? Or is whole life better than, you know, conversation seems to start with the product. And that is backwards from the way the Prudent Investor Act defines the process. The Prudent Investor Act defines the process as, first, measure your costs, know what they are, and then have reasonable expectations as to the rate of return or the benefits that you're likely to receive. As you mentioned, guarantees have a cost. A letter of credit from a bank that guarantees the payment of something has a cost. Cost for a guarantee inside a guaranteed universal life product has a cost. So measuring that cost as well as the other costs in the policy, the cost of insurance charges, the fixed administration expenses, the wrap fees, if any, if we're talking about a VUL, for instance, the wrap fees, the premium loads, measuring all of those and then quantifying them and then relating them to the benefits that are expected to be received. One of the benefits certainly can be ease of administration or certainty of payment, but simply going to the default of, you know, regardless of the cost, which is implied in the statement that I'm always going to use guaranteed products. Implicit in that statement is, I am not considering the cost. I am simply going with guarantees because I believe that universally, guarantees and ease of administration are always better, regardless of the cost of them. I don't think that will stand the test of time. The Cochran case kind of followed that path, and the Cochran case did fine for the trustee, which I think has given some trustees a false sense of security that GUL, which is where the Cochran trustee ended up, GUL may be the safe haven. But there were several arguments that the plaintiff attorney introduced into the record in the Cochran case about the duty to incur only those costs that are reasonable and appropriate to the trust, and they never made an argument about that. So there is no case law that tests that part of the Prudent Investor Act as it stands right now.
I'm certainly not here to suggest that you can't own an NLG contract in a trust. In fact, our company sells NLG contracts, and I'm not here to suggest you shouldn't put those in trust. It's just my view is that when you look at the appropriate investment as a trustee, you need to look at what's out there in light of all of the options you have and the purpose of the trust and the situation of the trust and the situation of beneficiaries. And you have to weigh that certainty against cost and what that current assumption contract has and the cash values that current assumption product brings to you. And, you know, I even think to some extent, when you look at how you compare a current assumption against a G product, I think it depends in part, maybe in large part, on the quality of the carrier that's especially issuing that current assumption product.
Oh, and the guarantee product. I mean, if the guarantee product is guaranteed by someone who is ranked in the top decile for financial strength and claims paying ability versus another product that is at the risk of stating the obvious, I think most trustees already get this, but just to state the obvious, versus a product that has comparable costs and it's ranked in the top quartile instead of the top decile, you would not select a AA rated bond that's paying the same yield as a AAA rated bond. You would always take the AAA rated bond that's paying the same yield because you have higher security and the same return. Same idea with life insurance. You would certainly choose the higher rated company, all other things being equal. I think part of the challenge in this for trustees is what you said in that last comment is there are hundreds of products out there, hundreds and hundreds of products, dozens of GUL, dozens of whole life, dozens and dozens of whole life, dozens and dozens of current assumption, dozens and dozens of variable. And so I think one of the dilemmas the trustee faces, and at the risk of shameless self-promotion for what we publish, is a trustee really can't, as a practical matter, they just can't. Even if they were to quadruple their fees, they can't really look at everything that's out there. But they have a duty to do what is reasonably prudent. So if you have an NLG or a guaranteed product and you measure it or the costs against a benchmark for all UL products and its costs are really, really good, so you're getting good costs and guarantees, D's in a really good spot right there. However, if you have a guaranteed product that when you measure the costs, their costs are above the average of all of the costs for all UL products, which is very easy to do when you have a database, then they have that decision support information without the impractical job of trying to figure out everything that's out there.
I mean, just our company alone, you know, we've got a couple of current assumption universal life products. We've got an NLG. We've got a couple of different variable contracts, one with and one without a guarantee. You've got term, you know, the amount of just products that our company alone has, there's so many out there. I sometimes myself have a tough time recalling every single product that's out there as an option. I mean, I think that's why it's so important, as you said, about process. You have to be sure as a trustee, and I think as an agent who is working with a trustee, that there be a process that goes through when the decision's being made on what insurance to put inside of that trust. Because even if you have a trust that is drafted in a way to try to eliminate or at least to restrict the liability exposure that the trustee has as to the selection of the investments, things don't go well, and beneficiaries go to court with the advantage of 20/20 hindsight, the absence of a process is pretty hard to explain if something went wrong, despite that trust may or may not say.
Yeah, and Patty Spencer, who also did a radio show with us about the Cochran case, made some specific cautionary comments about the exculpatory legislative language. While it may feel comfortable before it's tested, it may not provide the protection the trustee is seeking. From a practical perspective, not a legal perspective, as that's not the credentials I hold, but from a practical perspective, you know, we're seeing agents, life insurance agents and brokers who are clearly not fiduciaries in the eyes of the law, being sued for breach of fiduciary duty under a common law definition of fiduciary, which goes something along the lines of, if you're sitting across from the client and the client says, you know, is this really the best thing for me? And the person sitting across from the client says, yes, this is the best thing for you. And they've not disclaimed that they're not a fiduciary and they've not disclosed their role as simply an agent or a broker or disclosed that they're a trustee not serving in a fiduciary. You know, when a client looks the trustee or the agent or the broker in the eyes and says, is this what's right for me? You know, in this day and age, 99 times out of 100 or higher, the advisor is saying, yes, it is. And so the litigation for or the lawsuits that have been filed for breach of fiduciary duty under this common law definition of fiduciary duty have yet to pan out. But I can't imagine that ending up in a good place for the agent or the broker or a trustee relying on the exculpatory language in this day and age of, you know, increased consumerism, increased disclosure, increased consumer protection. I just don't know that that's going to work out well.
You know, certainly, I think, and we've had this conversation before in this area, I think we're really just kind of on the forefront of what is probably a clarification of the laws regarding the responsibilities of the fiduciary. You know, you've compared this to ERISA on past shows, and to me, that does seem like a fair thing to compare this to. You know, we're starting to see dribs and drabs of lawsuits and clarification out there, but when agents and trustees are looking at these kinds of situations and looking at these decisions on what to buy inside of these trusts, you need to understand that if this goes bad, if there's an unhappy beneficiary at some point down the road, that lawsuit's not going to be brought today. That lawsuit might be brought in 5 years or 10 years or 20 years from now, when we could be looking at rules that have evolved considerably from where they are now. So, you know, to look here today and try to draw a generalization from the handful of cases that are out there right now, I think is a bit dangerous. Again, you need to be cautious. You need to be sure that you're looking at reasonable amounts of alternatives, and you need to be sure that you have sensible, documented process in place. I also think it's helpful to have, and I don't know what you think about this. I guess this is just my view, but I would be interested to know what you think. Do you think it's enough just to have the trustee involved in that decision that's made as to what you buy, or do you think the insured and or the beneficiaries should be consulted when you're making that kind of a decision?
In a trustee setting?
Yes.
I think recognizing that there are family circumstances and planning situations where it just doesn't make sense to involve trustees. Recognizing that, I think that a trustee is well served in a variety of ways to get the beneficiaries, at least keep them in the loop, if not actually involved, particularly in a life insurance trust. The life insurance trust business model for years had been, you know, there's not much work. We'll hold this thing. We'll send out the letter once a year. We'll send out the premiums once a year. And we'll charge a de minimis fee because there's really not much expense and there hasn't been much liability. So we'll do that. And they didn't do it just because they're altruistic. They did it because someday there'd be $1 million or a $10 million death benefit, and they wanted to manage those assets. And in the considerable conversations I've had with trustees over the past 5 years, it has been very surprising to me how many beneficiaries actually keep those assets nowadays with that trustee. And so, you know, from a legal perspective, if the trustees are involved in, say, or that actually consent to any changes to a life insurance policy, I mean, if the beneficiaries had consented to the change in the Cochran case, then I don't know if the beneficiaries would have had a leg to stand on in filing suit against the trustee. Similarly, if the trustee has a relationship with beneficiaries when that $2.5 million is what actually came in, or if they kept the VUL policy and the $8 million came in, then the trustee certainly has a much higher probability of retaining those assets to then manage them, which is maybe in more of their sweet spot of their business model. So yes, I think keeping beneficiaries involved to the extent that it's practical given family circumstances and planning situation that you do it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that was a broad generalization because certainly, I mean, I got my daughter 6, and if I create a trust with her as the beneficiary, well, it doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense to consult a 6-year-old. But if my mom is creating a trust and I'm 50 years old and a trust lawyer, I don't know why the trustee wouldn't want to get my take on what he's going to do. It's certainly going to make it a lot harder for me to sue after the fact.
I'd like to come back to, you'd mentioned that we're kind of in the frontier of this industry. We're just like in the early days of ERISA. There were far fewer trustees actually following ERISA than there were 10 or 15 years later. And it took some regulations and it took some lawsuits to go from where they were to where they ended up. And I think the same thing is going to happen. You had mentioned timeframes of 5, 10, or 20 years. The regulations are, as we speak, changing. The New York producer disclosure regulations are now in effect. So anybody doing business in New York has new disclosure requirements, which includes disclosing the role that they serve. Are they representing the interests of the client or are they representing the interests of the insurance company? There is a notification requirement that the policy owner has a right to know what the compensation is. So, I mean, these are all issues. And Dodd-Frank included in it, which was the financial reg reform bill, it included in it a section asking the SEC or mandating the SEC to study the rules governing different types of financial advisors, namely brokers versus RIA, registered investment advisors, brokers having one standard of care because they're representing some family of products distributed by their distribution system, and registered investment advisors having a different standard of care because they legally represent the interests of the client. And the distinction between the two in the marketplace has clearly been grayed, with both types of advisors carrying business cards that both say financial consultant, both say financial advisor. So, you know, the consumer is having a hard time making that distinction. And so the SEC was empowered or required to study that issue. And from everything I'm reading and people that I'm talking to who have met with the SEC, it looks like they're going to come down on the side of, if you say you're doing what's best for the client, then you need to adhere to a fiduciary standard. If you disclose that you simply represent XYZ insurance company and that your job is to distribute that insurance company's products or these three insurance companies' products or whatever the case may be, and that you disclose or disclaim any fiduciary standard, if you make that clear, then that's two different things. But we know that that's not what's going on in the marketplace right now. So the rules that are going into effect, not 5, 10, 20 years from now, but that are going into effect right now are the ones that you're talking about.
While I think that the people who are acting as trustees need to be, especially if you're a corporate fiduciary, you'd better be an expert on these issues that Barry's speaking about. But if you're an insurance professional or if you're a casual trustee, even if you aren't expert on these rules, I think common sense goes a long way, right? You just have to understand that these transactions are going to be looked at, if they are ever looked at, they're going to be looked at with the benefit of hindsight. And looking at options and documenting the reasons that you make the decision that you make, and having a process to get to that point, even if it's not the world's best process. You know, I think that's one of the things that we learned in the court case that when we had you on earlier, Barry, that we talked
in
about.
In Cochran, absolutely.
Is even if you don't have the world's greatest process, even if with the benefit of hindsight, you can go back in and say, you know, you could have done this and it would have been a better process. I don't think you have to have the best process. You just have to have a sensible, defensible process. So, you know, just I think common sense is just look at options, have a process, and to the extent possible, involve people that are going to be impacted by the decision that you make and document what you did and why you did what you did. I mean, to me, again, it would be great if everybody had the level of expertise that you've got in this area. I think a lot of people would save themselves a lot of frustration and bad results.
I agree. Just like what happened in the early days of ERISA, you know, not everybody has to have the level of expertise that you described, because service providers come into being in order to address certain segments of that expertise. Now, before ERISA, there wasn't much of a third-party administration business for retirement plans. And then after ERISA, it was a rapidly growing business. Before the Uniform Prudent Investor Act, I don't know that there was such a thing as a third-party administrator for trust-owned life insurance. And now there are several who are servicing the biggest banks in the country. So I don't know that you need to have the type of expertise that you were ascribing to me. You do need to have, as you said, a process that in today's day and age meets the fundamental elements, or that includes the fundamental elements of that defined in the Prudent Investor Act, because, as you said, the Cochran case has set a rather low bar that, you know, if you include the material element process, then you won't be second-guessed on your result.
I just think when you look at an insurance purchase and you're looking at, again, products that are out there today, I mean, as you point out, you've got variable, you've got guaranteed variable, you've got whole life, you've got NLG, you've got current assumption universal life, you've got hybrid universal life products where they have guarantees to life expectancy, but operate also as a current assumption product. You've got so many different types of insurance products that are out there. And in the tremendous uncertainty we have around the estate tax on what the exemption is going to be, what the rate's going to be, when you lock yourself into an NLG product that has, again, you have the certainty out there, but you also have the certainty that you're not going to have any cash value. And you also have the certainty that if your situation should change, on most of those products, you can't change your funding stream and or reduce the face. Or, I mean, you pay and you get the death claim, or you don't pay and you don't get anything. I mean,
right.
That's kind of certainty you get with most of those kinds of products. And when you balance that against some of the other types of products that are out there, like current assumption or the hybrid current assumption products that have the NLGs to life expectancy, when you look at those products and you see for a lower illustrated cost, you also get substantially higher illustrated cash values. I just think it's a dangerous position to assume that NLG product is necessarily better than that current assumption product just because of the one attribute that it has, which is the certainty around it. You know, especially when you're operating today with interest rates near or at historically low levels, you're pushing off at a pretty significant cost your client's risk of further reductions in interest rates when the likelihood of further reductions in interest rates aren't all that great.
Agreed. The other side of this, though, Randy, we've probably spent enough time talking about the potential negatives about, you know, a go-to product and the potential negatives of, you know, all these new responsibilities and at levels of expertise or new service providers or whatever.
I guess I just want to leave it with is I don't know that you should have a go-to product. I guess my takeaway from this is you should look at the products that are out there and look at what the situation is and then make a decision as to what is the right one.
I agree, and I think there is great opportunity. My belief is that this is the largest business opportunity, not necessarily new sales, but this is the largest business opportunity that the life insurance industry has seen, at least in my days in this business since the age of 19. There's some adage that says with every change comes opportunity, and with great change, it would make sense that there's great opportunity. You know, we got Dodd-Frank, we got New York producer disclosure rules. We've got great change in the life insurance industry, and I think that opportunity, there is trillions, literally trillions of dollars in life insurance policies, and nobody knows, very, very few, know what they're actually being charged for cost of insurance charges, admin fees, wrap fees, and premium loads. And very, very few know what they're getting in the way of investment performance. In fact, I would hazard to say that most every client of those listening on this call, or most every listener on the call, has a client, and they know what they're getting on their child's mutual fund account or college fund. They know what they're getting. They know what they're paying in fees. They know what they're getting. And they might have a $10 million life insurance policy, and they have no idea what they're being charged and no idea what they're actually getting. And the Prudent Investor Act is a catalyst. It's an instruction manual for how you go about managing these trillions of dollars in life insurance that heretofore have been, for the most part, if not in an absolute sense, totally unmanaged. I think there, from the trustees' perspective, there will be trustees. I know of a couple of smaller ones. There are trustees who are actively seeking out ILETs to serve as trustee on ILETs because they're marketing professionally managed trust-owned life insurance and going after the marketplace where, you know, Uncle Bob or Brother Bill is serving as trustee on a policy where, again, they don't know what they're being charged. They don't know what they're getting. They're going after that market and saying, we want to professionally manage your trust-owned life insurance. From the agent or broker's perspective, it's the same thing, that, you know, people who are being overcharged, in a survey by Tillinghast Towers Perrin said that there's as much as a 40% swing off the mean, an 80% swing in total between best available rates and terms and poorly priced products. If somebody's being charged, overcharged by 80%, there is a opportunity there to really add value, to really, really help a client who might have a really, really old policy and be compensated for doing so. So I just think that this is a period of great change, but it is a period of great opportunity, both for trustees to evolve their business models and for agents and brokers to bring value.
Gary, certainly since the tax law changes came out in mid-December, I've been asked a lot about what markets are out there for life insurance in the new year, what things are you going to focus on, what things are you going to look at from your department. And one of the things that I've heard a lot of, interestingly, tax lawyers, trust and estates lawyers, not insurance professionals as much as I'm hearing it from the trust and estates lawyers, saying to me is, this is a great time for insurance people to be going back in and looking at trust-owned life insurance contracts, because if you have policies that are not performing, you have an opportunity now whereby you can make additional gifts to those trusts to change the funding of those contracts, and you can fix a lot of problems that you might have with existing life insurance that's already inside of trust. But it's a key time to look at those contracts and decide, is this the best policy to keep? Should I increase the funding of this thing? Should I stop the funding of this and buy a new one? What should I do? But what these trust and estates lawyers are saying is use this opportunity to go in and look at existing trusts, because with the increased exemption level that's out there, there's an opportunity to do things, fix things that you might not have otherwise had.
I'm hearing that too. And the first thing that I make sure I say is that the review that you described is two separate steps or two separate reviews. Yes, there is an opportunity to get more money into these trusts. So a policy to help restore the funding of an underfunded policy, let's say. However, first, is that policy a suitable policy? Again, I'll analogize to the retirement business. If I have a retirement account and the account value and the contributions I'm currently putting into it are only going to grow to, you know, several hundred thousand dollars by the time I'm age 65, you know, that's not going to be enough to retire on. So what's the problem? Is the problem that I'm not putting enough money in, or is the problem that I am putting enough money in and the charges inside my retirement plan are excessive? So those are two separate steps that, yes, now is a good time to make up funding, but first ascertain the suitability of the holding in the trust, and then, if it's suitable, add money. If it's not suitable, lower your expenses and then add money.
Well, I think that's a good point is you needed this, but now we have an opportunity because at least with the added exemptions that people have now, you at least can go in and do that two-step analysis. And if you do believe that the best solution is to keep what you have and increase the way you fund it, that option is there. And if, as you say, the best solution is to scrap what you have, then that option is still there as well. So exemptions that folks have is, you know, when you're up against situations whereby you may have maxed out or you thought you had maxed out your lifetime exemption amounts and
right.
your annual exclusion amounts, where you had situations where you thought you were maxed out, now you're not. So it's a
right.
good opportunity to open up those doors now and do that an analysis
Absolutely.
That you might have been afraid to do before, because if you didn't like the answer you got, you weren't sure where the extra funds were going to come from. Now that's not the problem.
Right. Right.
But this is certainly is an area that, you know, is going to continue to evolve, you know, as we've said in past shows and on this show as well. Where this thing heads to is, I don't think we're where we're finally going to be yet. It's going to continue to move as we go through here. And, you know, I just think it's important that we continue to have you on every so often and talk about the developments that are out there and let our listeners know that this is an area that deserves focus, whether they're an insurance professional, whether they're a trustee, whether they're a estate planning lawyer. This is something that impacts, I think, all of our listeners. You know, any last words of advice while I have you on this time that you'd like to leave with our listeners, Barry?
Back to the change and opportunity thing. As I was thinking about that, I remember one of the fans of theinsuranceadvisor.com. I was having lunch with a CPA, one of the big whatever. Big.
I don't know how many there are these days either. Yeah, I used to work with it was 8 of them when I used to do it.
Yeah, so I don't know, and this was some time back, so I don't know if it was, you know, big 8, big 6, big 4. I don't know how many it was at the time, but I was bemoaning how, you know, the insurance advisor .com just wasn't growing as fast as I was hoping or wanting. And he said to me, you know, there's only two people who don't like change. He said, do you know who they are? And I said, no, but I'm sure you'll tell me. And he said, well, first are the people who are directly and adversely affected by the change. And I said, thanks so much. I could have probably figured that one out by myself. And I said, so who else? And he said, everybody else. Nobody likes change. Which says to me that, you know, in a period of great change, that means that it is all the more great opportunity for those who go through the learning process and the learning curve. Because if it's change, it's new. So there is something to the learning process. And this is one of the greatest opportunities to develop new businesses, whether they be service providing businesses to support trustees, whether they be professionally managed trustee services, simply serving as prudent delegatee, simply helping trustees understand what they're being charged, understand what they're actually getting, and putting yourself, if you're an agent or broker, putting yourself in position to do an exchange to a more suitable holding. I just think this is one of the greatest periods of opportunity in the history of this business that I've been part of.
You know, certainly with more related to the tax law changes that we've had the last few weeks, I've been asked by a lot of folks, you know, about what we're going to promote in the coming year and about, you know, what impact it's going to have on their business. And, you know, I've had a lot of people talk to me about those sorts of things. And my response has been very much like what you just said, is change, despite the fact that it scares everybody, change is generally good. And if one of the things in the insurance business, agents want reasons to get in front of their clients and to talk to them. Insurance is a great product. So many positive attributes to life insurance that are out there. You know, it's the tax-free buildup of the cash values. It's the, you know, it's the treatment of the death benefit. It's the timing of the cash at this time when the family needs it because of the death of the insured. There's so many great things about life insurance that have nothing to do with estate taxes at all, that people want life insurance when agents talk to them about the needs that life insurance have. And now between the tax bill and between a lot of these fiduciary questions that are starting to arise and with the new standards that are out there, you've got a lot of reasons to talk to your clients, talk to fiduciaries. There's so many reasons to go out and talk to people about planning issues that, you know, you're going to find so many situations where people need different insurance, where they need more insurance. I just think it's a golden age for life insurance right now. I think that all these things that are scaring us, whether that's the tax bill or whether it's a lot of these fiduciary issues, even though a lot of these might be scary to some folks, I think they are all very, very positive for our industry.
That's what our subscribers are finding, I assure you. That is exactly what our subscribers are finding.
Well, Barry, as always, I really appreciate your time. You know, I'm thankful for your thoughts on this. And you know, I'm sure as we go through the year, we'll have more opportunities to discuss some of these fiduciary issues. So until then, we'll let you go, but I'm sure you'll be back before the end of the year. I just can't believe we're going to get through 2011 without some new developments in this area. I think it's inevitable.
I look forward to it.
All right, Barry. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry and Randy. If you'd like information on this or any other topic covered on John Hancock's Advanced Markets Radio, go to jhsalesnet.com. For John Hancock's Advanced Markets Radio, I'm Ray Innings. Plan on us next week. For financial professional use only, not for use with the public, insurance products are issued by John Hancock Life Insurance Company, USA, Boston, Mass. 02116, not licensed in New York, and John Hancock Life Insurance Company of New York, Vahalia, New York, 10595. This material is for informational purposes only. Although many of the topics presented may involve tax, legal, or accounting issues, neither John Hancock nor any of its agents, employees, or registered representatives are in the business of offering such advice. This material is not intended or recorded to be used with and cannot be used for the purposes of avoiding any penalty that may be imposed by the Internal Revenue Service. This recorded material may have been recorded to support the promotion or the marketing of the transaction or topics addressed by the recorded material. Individuals interested in these topics should consult with their own professional advisor to examine legal, tax, or accounting or financial aspects of these topics.
Barry Flagg is a founder and inventor of theinsuranceadvisor.com, which is a provider of insurance product information that does not endorse any broker, dealer, financial planner, registered representative, insurance professional, insurance product, or insurance company. Neither Barry D. Flagg nor theinsuranceadvisor.com is affiliated with John Hancock Life Insurance Company.